scattered across
New York via the Paranormal Radio Network and also on UPRN 105.5 FM in New Orleans. For more information on the show and on my guests, visit the website at www.keyholepublishing.com. I want to thank you all for joining me this evening. And as always, guys, I want to hear from you. If you're listening live tonight, join us on the message board to discuss the program and add your questions and comments. Go to ParanormalRadioNetwork.com to join us in the virtual auditorium, where you can participate in the conversation through instant messaging. You can also email me anytime with your questions and comments. The address is kdolan@rochester.rr.com. You can also call into the show toll-free if you prefer. That number is 1-877-786-0562. And if you missed any of that, it's all on the webpage at www.keyholepublishing.com. I have to say I'm really excited about the show tonight. I am getting a chance to talk with a friend that I have not spoken with in ages, and we have a lot of business kind of stuff to catch up on, but also it's just going to be really, really fun just catching up. I want everyone to join me, in welcoming Guy Malone to Through the Keyhole tonight. Guy, thanks so much for coming.
Hi, thank you very much for having me. You sound great, by the way, on that intro.
Thank you. Hey, thanks.
Cut this down.
Any listeners who don't realize this, I've been doing this show for almost 3 years now, just almost exactly 3 years, in fact, because I started in June of 07, and it is now the end of May of 2010. And the first time I was ever on radio at all was on Guy Malone's show, Live from Roswell, and that was in February of 07. And I was so nervous. First of all, I couldn't understand why you would have asked me on the show to begin with. So that was really funny. And then I thought, you had a really cool idea, which was instead of inviting a UFO researcher like everyone else is doing, you invited me because I am married to a UFO researcher. And it was sort of cool that, you know, we're talking about what's that like. But I still didn't really think it would go over as well as it did.
I wish I still had a copy of that, actually. It went over really well, and I guess it was a good angle to, you know, what's it like working the table when everybody's wanting to come up and talk to Rich, or what's it like, you know, when he's hours and hours writing and answering emails, and you're just la-di-da, la-di-da, kind of like a football widow or something.
Yeah.
That's the perspective I was going for. Yeah. But I guess, like Joe Montaldo was pretty impressed with your radio voice and just your ability to handle yourself talking. It went really well, and I loved
Thanks.
I got the inside scoop on how you and Rich got married. That was probably never told on air before, was it?
No, I don't think it ever had been told on the air. I mean, Rich tells the story all the time, but in person, you know, we had never talked about
it. How you met, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, for anybody who's online now and wondering, he picked me up in a supermarket here in Rochester. So.
It was funny.
Yeah. It is a good story, and Rich tells it way better than I do, so I'm not sure how much detail I want to get into. But
so it's been a really good 3 years for you, I guess, huh?
Yeah, it really has. You know, I'm just having so much fun. It's more fun now. The more I get into it and the more comfortable I feel on it, on the air, just the more fun I have. It's really great. And when I started, you know, I didn't think I could do it. Honestly, I thought, I don't know, for some reason, people like the way I sound on that one show, but, you know, and I figured, well, I have a chance, let me just take it, and the worst that's going to happen is somebody's going to say, God, you stink, and they'll take my time slot away. I said, you know, they're not going to kill me, and that's going to be that, and it never happened, and it's still going well.
And now you're prime time, actually.
Yeah, I got moved to a more prime time slot, and...
You're like Frasier, you know? It's like you're the spinoff series of me that got canceled and then outlived it even longer.
Oh, no. Well, hey, Guy, I wanted to ask you about that. What happened with Live from Roswell? I mean, I know you haven't been on the air in a while, and I always understood that it had to do with a lot of other things were going on in your life, and you were just kind of scaling back to focus.
Scaling back is really the best answer. Yeah, I enjoyed it, but... In a sense, it had run its course. A lot of my motivation for doing it was just promoting the bigger upcoming things we had going, like the Roswell 2007, you know, conference that was huge, and a couple things we did afterwards. But as you know, from after 2007, newly married, and I went on to add another night on at work later on. And then we had this huge event in 2009, the first Christian Symposium on Aliens, which was like multitasking nightmare for a while, mm-hmm. getting all those details done, because that was like a three-day event. And it really was just scaling back, really, not having time to do everything I wish I had time to do. But it was definitely fun and educational for me, in fact, with all the people that I interviewed. I'm sure you get that feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my God. It's amazing how much there is to learn.
Yeah, just from the people you actually have on. They're even
right.
people you may know, and maybe you've seen them lecture. But just to have the chance to get to question them yourselves and ask the questions that are in your mind. And I used it to promote, you know, we've got the alternative view, so to speak, to a lot of people's mind. And I would have a lot of people that were prominent in the field of ufology, UFO research, and other topics as well. But just every now and then I'd slip in, for sure, the point of view that I wanted to be sure that got across in all of this. You know, same approach I did in Roswell 2007 and have been doing here, you know, off and on the whole time.
Yeah, and boy, you brought up the whole concept of, you know, running the conferences in Roswell. That was another thing I wanted to ask you about. When you first invited, well, the first time I was invited to speak was in 07. I mean, 2007 was a huge year for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it seems like that lecture actually mm-hmm. spun off of you and I actually doing what we're doing now, having
right.
a conversation on the phone. And I'm like, well, Karen, you're well-read and well-researched. If you were going to do a lecture, what would it be on? And you talked about media desensitization of children on the UFO phenomena right off the top of your head. I'm like, that sounds like a great lecture topic. Do you think you could do that? And remember, I do run this year's conference, if you know, so think before you answer that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and you know, I had to treat it the same way I treated the opportunity to go on the radio. You know, again, my first thought was, oh my God, I can't possibly do that. I don't have the skills. I don't have what it takes to do that. And then I thought, come on, when am I going to get a chance like this again? And, you know, what's the worst that'll happen? People will throw rotten tomatoes at me. Nobody's going to shoot me, you know. Maybe I won't be asked back again, but, you know, this is not irreparable. I might be embarrassed, but no more than that.
Well, no, it's the same as your program. Not only did you get asked back again in 2008 by Joe when he was organizing, how many other places have you done a version of that same lecture you started with?
Yeah, at Ryan Wood's Crash Retrieval Conference mm-hmm. in Las Vegas, and at the Bordentown UFO Congress with Pat Mercutillo. And, of course, I mean, this summer is going to be the third time that I've spoken in Roswell, although I'm doing a different topic this year. So that'll be
yeah, nice. So, looks
I
good.
Don't want to be the Teletubby lady.
Yeah.
I really, really
yeah.
don't.
Well, it's a real good lecture or book chapter if you ever get around to thinking along those lines, just how the media is desensitizing children over and over and over again with these images, with these messages and stuff like that. It kind of makes you wonder. I remember asking you, or we talked a little bit about, you know, do you think there's a plan or a conspiracy or an orchestration intentionally behind it or what?
Well, yeah, I do. And, you know, when I first brought up the question and first started looking into it, I thought, oh, this is crazy. You know, this is just ridiculous. And I started doing some research and actually found documentation that does support that. So, you know, I remember when I found that, I thought, oh, no, please, no, I don't want to see this. I said, yeah, okay, I got to put it in.
What are you talking about?
The Robertson panel, which was convened
yes.
by Project Blue Book, you know, and they issued a report in 1952, and they said, well, they were put together to look at the question of UFOs and is this a threat to national security? And they came back and they said, okay, UFOs themselves are not a threat to national security, but UFO sightings are a problem because so many people think they're seeing UFOs, they're going to tie up the phone lines. If something happens, if some astronomical event occurs, they're going to be tying up the phone lines, calling us, saying, oh, my God, the UFOs are landing. And they said, what if the military really does need to do something? We're not going to be able to communicate. And, by the way, personally, I think all that sounds like a cover story, but that's just me being paranoid. But that's what the official report says. So they said, yes, that's why we do need to manage public perception of UFOs. and they talked specifically about using mass media, using movies, and television was brand new at that time. In fact, I think it actually didn't really come out until a couple of years later, so they didn't really talk about TV, but they did mention movies. They mentioned film strips, which I kind of got a kick out of. Who knows about film strips now? And they specifically mentioned working with Walt Disney, in fact. And Walt Disney did produce some programs with them.
Beyond that, I remember I was researching something real recently for a talk, and I remember growing up in the 70s, I was born in 1968, every Sunday night of my childhood, it seems, was watching the two-hour Wonderful World of Disney on Sunday nights, like starting at 6 p.m. or so.
Yeah, I remember that.
But do you remember the show, is it Project Blue Book or Air Force UFO show that came on for an hour in the 70s? I could Google it real quick. I had it at the tip of my tongue earlier.
Yeah, I don't remember that one.
But there was a television program that came on, and it was based on the Project Blue Book officers. You know, it was sort of like Just the Facts, Ma'am, them doing their investigations and everything like that, mm-hmm. to where these Air Force officers working for Project Blue Book would go out and interview. And darn if they did not make that program, that they cut Wonderful World of Disney from 2 hours, the way it had always been, down to 1 hour. And then right afterwards, you know, you're already, as a kid or whatever, in the habit of watching NBC for 2 hours mm-hmm. on Sunday nights, and they stuck in this UFO show to follow The Wonderful World of Disney for like 2-3 seasons of my childhood. So I remember being probably 6, 7, 8 years old watching this UFO program every Sunday night as part of my routine, you know, right after being opened up by The Wonderful World of Disney.
I don't remember that.
I'm going to see if I can Google this, because I know people in the listening audience. You're on the chat thing right now.
Yep.
See if anybody...
And none of these people are giving me the answer here, so we're going to have to look it up ourselves. Jeez. Come on, guys. There was a little buzz about how Rich and I met, actually, on the chat room. That's funny.
Oh. I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the show or find it right now. It just followed Walt Disney World. I know that.
Yeah, we're saying in the 70s. Was it that World of Tomorrow?
No. Gosh. It's probably UFO show. Sorry, one hand here. After Disney. Let me try that. Someone will figure it out. We shouldn't waste a lot of airtime.
Yeah. It was in the 70s, though, because people are asking now in the chat room. They're trying to look it up. Was it in the 90s? Or?
Oh, no. I was a little kid.
Okay.
I was a little kid. I'm getting Grant Cameron's Disney UFO connection. It was Project Blue Book. It was based on Project Blue Book.
Okay.
Surely you've got more we can talk about.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of other things I wanted to ask you about. Gosh, I feel like I haven't talked to you in so long.
It's
so great to get a chance to catch up, because you've been working on Friday nights ever since my show got moved to Friday nights.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, our shows were back-to-back when we were both on the air. So we never did, once I got my own show, we were never interviewed on each other's shows. We never guest-hosted anymore, nothing like that, because it would have meant 4 hours of radio for one of us.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
We were both too wussy to do that, so...
I got the answer. Project UFO.
Project UFO. Now, I think I've heard of that.
Yeah, it was a one-hour UFO program based on Project Blue Book. It was just, my whole point in, you know, concerning what we were talking about, is that it was a 60-minute sci-fi series on NBC about two U.S. Air Force officers investigating. But they cut Disney from 2 hours to one. Mm-hmm. You've got every kid in the nation watching the program, probably, you know, Disney, and slip in the UFO show. First episode, February 1978. I was 10. Here's what it says online. The Wonderful World of Disney was shortened from 2 hours to 1 hour to make it for Project UFO. And then it moved to Thursday, and it followed the Waltons and Mork and Mindy.
Mork and Mindy. Well, how did what was their presentation of UFOs? What did they tell people to think about UFOs? And what is going on here?
Joe?
Hey, I'm not doing the phone thing. Somebody says aliens are calling. Maybe
yeah.
they
phone
are.
Home. Phone home.
Phone home. It's easy.
It was pretty straightforward. The program, it does. Uh-huh. It was pretty straightforward. Two guys in uniform and the typical military caps. It might have even been in black and white. I'm not sure. The picture I'm looking at is crazyabouttv.com/projectufo. HTML.
I mean, did they talk about UFOs like these are real, these are beings from elsewhere, or did they do the little debunking and the chuckle at the end?
Kind of both, if I remember. Again,
okay.
I was 10 watching this,
yeah.
But they were told, I'm reading from the text, their job was to do their best to prove that UFO sighting was real by eliminating every other possible explanation.
Wow.
So he explained it would not be wise to approach a sighting with the idea of proving it was not an alien encounter because you can't prove a negative. That's how the first episode starts off. And I do remember they would end some shows as just logging it as completely unexplained. But then sometimes, in kind of detective or Air Force fashion, they would get down to the bottom line, real natural explanation. But 10 years old, I'm being programmed by Disney, by following Disney to
well,
having
yeah.
in UFOs.
Well, I have to admit, I just watched a South Park episode last night that was all about Disney selling sex to kids, actually.
But, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was really funny. It was incredibly tacky, as South Park always is. And, you know, I wouldn't watch it for the longest time because I was like, oh, that's not even funny. That's just tacky. And I was so uptight, you know. But we had it on the other night, and I started snickering, and pretty soon I'm sitting there watching the whole thing, and it was very funny.
Yeah, you're right. It's real tacky, but sometimes I just find myself.
Is.
I don't.
You know,
we don't even have cable or, you know, major cable.
Well, I don't either. We have it on DVD. We watch everything.
Oh,
DVD.
Okay. You went out and bought it finally. You cracked from your
yeah.
moral
well,
high
did.
Ground.
My husband brings this stuff in the house now. I remember meeting Leah Haley several years ago. Like, I don't know, it was 04, 05 or something at one of the conferences out west. And she says, sweet, demure little person, and she was so funny, and she's like, I have a guilty secret. I love South Park. And I'm trying to imagine her watching South Park. She's so sweet, and South Park is so horrible, but it is funny. And
wow.
You know, and I have to say, I love shows that are not afraid to do things like come out and say Disney is selling sex to little kids. 'Cause it's,
wow.
I mean, they are. And it's just so refreshing to see that.
Yeah, I've heard a couple, like the Little Mermaid, the imagery built into a lot of it. I bet they give better examples than I'm going to give off the top of my head.
Yeah, you know, there are just so many. It's hard. When we're sitting here on the air, if I don't prepare something ahead of time and the conversation goes in a direction I wasn't expecting, trying to just come up with something. There are just too many.
I remember some clamor over the Beauty and the Beast animated thing because they'd always, in a nice way, Disney had always drawn flat-chested women, and then in the Beauty and the Beast, they finally changed that policy.
Oh.
At low-cut, you know, full figure, whatever dresses like that,
yeah.
And that was some clamor back in the yeah. 80s, 90s.
Wow, and they're all like that now. I mean, did you see Aladdin?
No, I don't think
I have.
Girl,
that girl's really distorted. I don't even know. Princess Jasmine or something is her name. I didn't see the movie, but I've seen that image so many times, and that's the one that people always bring up now when they complain about Disney portraying, you know, unrealistic physical images of girls. She's really, really distorted. And, you know, people will point at that and say, come on, our daughters are going to be trying to look like this or think they're supposed to look like this, and it's not possible. It's not human. She's got, like, a 12-inch waist.
Huh.
And it looks weird. She just looks kind of creepy.
Gee, so, I remember when I was growing up, all the fighting was over, you know, the violence and Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner, Bugs Bunny.
Which I also always loved.
People found something new to complain about. Okay.
Yeah.
It's a cartoon.
You gotta love that Acme company, you know?
Right.
Anything you want, you can get it at Acme.
They're handy.
Tanks, explosives.
Back-engineered UFOs, anti-gravity.
Yeah. Exactly, anything.
Acme.
That's wonderful. Hey, I wanted to ask you, speaking of Live from Roswell, which we were a while ago, do you have any plans to bring that back on the air?
I have occasionally played with the idea. There's even someone here that has a background in radio and marketing, and he has all the equipment to do, like, sound clips and music and overlays and then just upload it, whether it's pre-recorded or live. I've played with the idea, but, again, tyranny of the urgent, the important stuff and, you know, lectures, conferences, DVDs, you know, moving on and stuff like that just keeps taking the bulk of my time, the real time I have available to work on projects. It's a dangerous thing for me to try to add one more thing to my list.
Yeah. So tell me about the things that you are doing these days. I mean, I know that you have something to do with the Roswell UFO Festival coming up.
Oh, yeah.
You're presenting, and are you also organizing a conference there?
Both, actually. Yeah. We're doing, since 2003, I've organized a conference independent of the UFO Museum or before the city of Roswell even got involved.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing in itself, because prior to that, there really was only one event in Roswell. Am I right? I mean,
whatever the UFO Museum had going.
Okay, so there was really only one thing going on, and it was run by the UFO Museum. And so you were really the first person who started something independent and led to this situation we've got now, which is lots of events going on in this one town over the same weekend.
Yeah, it seemed a long time ago. There was the complaint that there's not enough going on, or, you know, the lectures, you'd have one at 9 in the morning and maybe not one again until 7. And people were just looking for stuff to do. There's absolutely nothing to do for children downtown. So if you're a tourist family or whatever, it was really cool. I thought the city stepped in for the 60th anniversary, and because I had organized conferences already, you know, that was the first time Rich spoke in Roswell. We invited you down. John Greenwald, never been there. David Cereda, Jim Hickman, Leah Haley, who you said. She was scheduled at the UFO Museum. They let me borrow her, in fact, because Eve Lorgen canceled. So, need to correct that. But
I didn't realize that you had asked Eve. And, you know, at that time I wouldn't have known who she was, because that was very early in my entry to the whole field, I guess.
But
I remember being in Roswell at first and not knowing who anybody was.
Really?
Yeah.
You're that newbie in
2004? I'm just trying to keep my mouth shut and not say anything stupid. No, but I was constantly poking Rich. Every time he and I were alone, I was like, okay, who was that? What's their thing? What's their book? Okay, what's this person doing in the field? Yeah, I was, like, taking notes. I was trying to memorize everything that whole weekend.
Oh, that's quite a chore, because that was huge weekend.
Yeah, it was.
This year I'm doing kind of my own thing, or our own thing, on the side. You know, Joe Jordan's going to be one of the speakers. He and I have developed this really effective, I call it the 1-2 punch, where I'll go first and set up some theology and, give examples from books and, you know, quotes of abductees and researchers, you know, John Mack and on like that, to set up the paradigm that this is spiritual phenomena, according to this amount of research. And then he'll follow it. We did this in Nashville just a couple months ago, a month ago at the end of April.
Mm.
And then he follows it with the testimonies and has some people come up live on stage as testimonies. And together, it's a very, you know, he's effective all on his own. I guess I'm effective to a degree all on my own. But this back-to-back thing, we've done it in Nashville and in Florida. Aside from what we're planning for this year's Roswell, if somebody's interested, it's the URL to check out the talks we're doing is theinvisiblebattle.com. That's the 2010 conference series that we're doing, not at the UFO Museum, not at the City of Roswell's event, but at the Public Library is where that one's scheduled. And unfortunately, you and I are almost going back to back. We've had our schedule up for a while, but I'm doing two talks, and one of them is for the city, though, at the city's event. I open on Friday at the Roswell Museum and Art Center with I'm really surprised they allowed it. I'm not even sure if they know on my side. It's not a spiritual natured talk. I'm not doing religion and the city or politics together. But have you ever seen the site I have, RoswellUFOCrash.com?
I haven't seen that one, no. You have several sites.
Yeah, they're all, go to alienstranger.com. And
yeah, I've got that one open right now.
Okay, yeah, just scroll down on there.
Okay.
But before Nick Redfern even had his book, his 2005 book on body snatchers,
mm-hmm.
in 2002, I think, I started writing RoswellUFOCrash.com, and it proposes a man-made view of the Roswell incident.
Mm.
You're familiar with the terms, I'm sure, and we can get into more for your audience, but Operation Paperclip, Nazi UFOs,
right.
the German technology that got imported over here, and some in Russia and some in Argentina, depending on where
right.
these scientists wound up. And
so for any listeners who aren't quite following this, Operation Paperclip was the name of an American military operation after World War II, where they brought Nazi scientists over to the United States and put them to work instead of treating them like war criminals. And, you
right.
know, people have mixed feelings about this, but I have to say, I mean, the truth is these people were doing valuable work, and we needed to know what they were doing. So, I mean, I really, really don't like the fact that we did that, but it was the best way to find out what they were working on.
Yeah, and I raised that point early on. You know, it's highly debatable whether they even should have done what they were doing,
mm-hmm.
but to kind of unpack what you said, the German military, the Nazis, were working on flying disc technology. The very stuff that you see in the famous Kenneth Arnold 1947 sighting he had a few months before the Roswell incident, you know, there's photos and there's models and diagrams of prototype stuff that the German Nazis were working on right before the end of the war, and they never got it fully operational. They never got it in mass production, but they had, you know, the Horton brothers flying disc is one technology. The Hanabu is a real popularly well-known one. If you read stuff like Man-Made UFOs, there's a book titled mm-hmm. by that, using the book Project UFO, spelled with a K, and a couple of others that just document the Germans had flying, literally flying saucers
mm-hmm.
in prototype but not mass production. And the CIA historian that I quote on that site says that they found out later, after raiding all their bunkers and capturing the scientists, that the quote is, Hitler not only had a secret weapon, he had what we would today call a UFO. So fast forward that, what you were talking about, the U.S. military imported over 120 German scientists. And over the decades, it went into the thousands, actually, according to Linda Hunt, her book, The Paperclip Conspiracy. But we brought them here secretly, hiding them in Texas and in White Sands, New Mexico, with the strict intent purpose of building that technology for us, as well as to prevent the Soviets from getting these scientists. And you're right, many of them were war criminals, many of them were Nazis. It's called Operation Paperclip because President Truman also agreed that we needed the technology, but he didn't want to let any true Nazi war criminals into the country. So the CIA, or what became the CIA, paperclipped fake dossiers about their background on top of their real records, with the assumption that he was just going to scan the top page of these 100, you know, some people he's letting into the country. But many of them were war criminals, and they did human experimentation projects as well, horrible abuses in the concentration camps, and some of them were just, you know, hijacked by the Nazi party. You know, I'm sure they had this work for us or die thing going.
Yeah.
They weren't really Nazis at heart, but...
Well, right. I mean, that's what I keep thinking. A lot of these guys probably were scientists who were pressed into service by the Nazis. I mean, technically, yes, they were working for them, but they may not have been very sympathetic to them.
Yeah. Probably pressed into service is a good,
yeah.
real good phrase. I'm going to use that, by the way. Thank you.
Okay.
But, you know, the premise of all this is, and I'm far from the only one that's been presenting this nowadays. I got tipped off to it by Mike Heiser, his first book, The Facade. I know you've interviewed him and met him several times here in Roswell. You know, he's a good PhD kind of researcher, low-key. And I just started Googling all the stuff available on it. But, yeah, we had scientists who were familiar with exotic and alternative flying disc and saucer technology on U.S. soil beginning in 1945 and 1946. Their purpose was to build that stuff for us. And I'll be laying it out with photos of the old crafts and stuff like that and the documentation from some of the government documents. And then, bam, 1947, a disc crashes not 200 miles away from where these guys live secretly, unknown to the American public. And, yeah, the government covered it up. And really, I think the whole thing centers around moral outrage. You know, those Nazis, Nazi guys, you know,
yeah.
I lost two sons fighting them in the war. Now they're on the payroll?
Yeah.
I think in 1947, moral outrage. This wasn't even declassified fully until the 70s.
Yeah,
I
can totally see
that. The whole Operation Paperclip thing.
Of course, I can also totally see, you know, we want to take everything that they learned, that they were working on. You know, we want access to everything they gained during that time. I can totally understand that, too. But, if I were a parent who'd lost a son over there, I'd like to shoot him. I don't care.
Yeah.
No, shoot him. Yeah. I've gotten a little tougher since I have kids. I'm
a little
quicker
better
on the draw.
Yeah, definitely. That's the premise of the view I'm presenting, that, you know, there is a lot of supporting evidence for human experimentation on handicapped children and progeria victims. Nick Redfern really takes the angle of nuclear irradiated prisoners of war from both Japan and German that we had kept here. I'll be kind of quoting a little bit from his book as well as Mike Heiser's research and then just other stuff that's on the internet and in, you know, books that are readily available.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm using the phrase, and I should probably trademark it, is that, you know, a spacecraft was not being covered up. A spacecraft was the cover up for what was really going on that the government didn't want people to know about.
Hmm.
But the cool thing I get bragging rights on, or at least I did until a couple months ago, was for over 5 years, if you typed into Google Roswell UFO crash, my site was the number one match on it.
Oh, cool.
So, you know, however speculative the view is, it's obviously getting some prominence and it's getting some exposure. Now it's number two only to Wikipedia's entry.
Wow.
So that's okay, too. But I'm really honored and surprised that the city of Roswell, in their own Roswell UFO Festival, Roswell Symposium, that you and your husband Richard and Dennis Balthaser locally, Dr. Don Burleson, Peter Robbins are all speaking at, the opening lecture, they're allowing me to do this publicly, is to get up and tell all these people who come to Roswell for the festival, no, it was man-made. It's not really aliens. Why are you here?
Well, you know, because they're there because something happened. And either way, as you said, if the saucer is the cover-up, then there's still a big story there.
Right.
I mean, if something happened that, if our military would rather we thought a flying saucer crashed, then that would be a pretty big deal, too.
Yeah, and that they're lying to us about the saucer craft, about the alien craft.
Yeah, I mean, that's ultimately what it comes down to for me, is that Roswell is the point where we started to realize that our government is lying to us about this.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I'm trying to get a little sound or a little video clip. There's this wonderful piece of Roswell history called, you know, wonderful, depending on your point of view, but it was for 3 years when I first moved here, there was a play outdoors at the amphitheater called Roswell the Musical, directed and written by a guy from Texas who finally got mad at us and he took his toys and, you know, went back to his own sandbox. So we haven't had it here for years, but it's a musical based on the Roswell incident where the male lead is a reporter coming to get the scoop and the female lead is the general's daughter who's sworn to secrecy. But they have this cover-up song. All throughout the beginning of the play, the military guys are just local Sam, Bob, Art type kind of people. You know, that they're real relatable, they're human. And at one point, the song, the cover-up plays, and they all put on dark glasses all of a sudden and begin singing cover-up, cover-up. And it's a comedic piece, it's intended to be. But it's very profound, and like you said, what I found was a 1945 article on Time Magazine on Operation Paperclip, to where the media was diverted from interviewing or talking or knowing what the government was doing. And I'll be suggesting in this lecture that what we call the truth embargo, that what we call the era of government secrecy that we believe began in 1947, I've actually got a 1945 article from Time, or a quote anyway, I don't have the article, that actually shows the government, you know, shunning the media, telling them to go away, don't talk about this. I'll be suggesting the era of government secrecy began in 1945 with Operation Paperclip. It didn't begin in 1947.
Now, what exactly were they trying to steer people away from in 1945, though? Was it away from Operation Paperclip, or away from something to do with UFOs? So it was Operation Paperclip. Okay.
There was a boat that the first German scientists were arriving on, and the media was kind of there for some reason to meet them. Let me punch it up real, as quickly as I can find. It's American Heritage or a BBC article I've got archived now.
Now, see, I was going to ask, how on earth did they distract the media without Lindsay Lohan?
Yeah, what they had back then, not even Marilyn Monroe. Here's the quote that I'll be sharing from an American Heritage article. Front page of the New York Times on November 17, 1945, bore a curiously vague headline. 88 German scientists reach here, reputedly with top war secrets. They came here on an ocean liner. They were whisked away aboard a fleet of buses. And the quote is, unusual precautions were taken to keep the arrival secret, and reporters who went on board the ship and found the 88 men waiting to land were warned away, the Times reported. Then the paper speculates on what they're doing, and it turns out they were right, but that paragraph ends with the purpose of this whole Operation Paperclip, to jumpstart American high-tech industry.
Wow.
Great, good BBC article on this, too, that I'll be sharing.
Cool.
But again, you know, if I can have any bragging rights at all, these are two huge articles in the BBC and on American Heritage that talk about Operation Paperclip, that talk about their connection to high-tech American disc stuff. They both came out in 2005, same time Nick Redfern's book did. But thanks to, I'd say, Mike Kaiser's help, you know, I had a website promoting this view as early as 2002. You know, no nails in the coffin, no smoking gun, but the overview, very well presented, and, you know, some people have told me convincing.
Wow.
So
well,
that's what
know,
the city is allowing me to give to people for their open-minded consideration. You know, they're not
really,
they're not hucksters. They're not pushing a product. You know, our tourism, you know, the reasons to come to Roswell actually do go beyond the UFO incident and stuff like that. And I want to say something about the integrity of the city, the mayor, and all that at the end of it, because even if you don't like my view, you know, this, to me, it's like a classy way to duck the Rotten Tomatoes that you were talking about. You know, I know this isn't what you came here to hear. I'm sorry, but you know, let's give a round of applause to the city of Roswell for being open-minded enough to, you know, let you make up your own mind about what happened here and not push a particular point of view on you just because we make money from it.
I think that's fantastic, and that's one of the things that has always impressed me since the first time I went to Roswell and got to meet some of the people who were involved in putting this together. You know, it's just that whole attitude that they're not trying to push something. They're not trying to push a particular agenda or any particular point of view. They want to promote open-minded discussion and research, and, you know, whatever somebody finds in their research on the Roswell incident, they want it brought out and presented and discussed. And I just, that's how all the research should be. You know, that's what we should all be doing in all fields of UFO research. And especially these days, what I'm seeing more and more on the internet is anytime anyone presents some kind of new aspect of research, any new facts they've uncovered, any new conclusions they've drawn, they get attacked.
Yeah.
You know, usually by people who are hiding behind anonymous screen names, which really burns me. And,
yeah,
you know,
good point.
A couple people who do this I at least have to respect because they use their own names. and, you know, I may not like the things they say or the way they go after people, but I do at least admire their ability to put their name on it. But, you know, it really, really burns me when people use an anonymous screen name and start posting things. You know, like this whole MUFON thing that's going on now. There's a big controversy now about someone who said things at a Texas MUFON meeting that apparently were pretty derogatory, or they're taken that way. Now, I haven't done a lot of research into it right now. The videos I've seen are in, it seems like, about 500,000 pieces, and I haven't had time to go through all of them and read all the transcripts. But I did notice that it was all put forth by someone on the Internet who was using a screen name. I looked at one or two of the pieces of the video, and I honestly didn't see anything wrong with anything that was being said. There were things that could be twisted around to seem very derogatory, but, you know, if you were there, it's just the way people talk to each other. And I'm sure if somebody really wanted to, they could take our conversation right now and twist it around and say that we're saying terrible things about people.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's always doable if you really want to. But it just seems almost as if there's a movement to split the field, to split people apart. And instead of promoting communication and pooling information and research, there's this backbiting, and there's, you know, people have this instinct to sort of jump down someone's throat as soon as they try to bring information out. And I've seen people starting to post on blogs and talking about really interesting things, and then almost immediately, you know, somebody will jump all over them, and they're like, okay, that's it. You know what? I'm getting off this. I'm getting back to my life because I don't need this. And they're scaring away some really good people.
Yeah, even I found, I'm sure you're the same way, even people that I know from the outset, I disagree with. You know, I have my own dogmas and my own views and mission, what I'm here to present and get across. But I learn more from people I disagree with a lot of the time. And, you know, nobody's got it all wrong. You know, I can pick up, even if it's a piece of data that I later turn around and use as supportive of my view. You know, there's, you know, Kevin Randall, the UFO researcher. He's one of the authors. Yeah, he's one of the authors of with Don Schmidt of The Truth About the UFO Crash at Roswell.
Uh-huh.
His blog is fantastic, and he was sitting there talking about. I'll probably quote him. I wrote him and asked him if I could, or that I would if he didn't object. But you know, he's using the Roswell 1947 newspaper things. You know, some people get from that one or two articles in July 47 that it was an alien craft. Some people get that it was Mogul or a weather balloon, and then later the Air Force explanation of the Mogul balloon. He's like, how can so many different people be reading the same article and walk away with such different impressions? And he just emphasizes that it kind of depends on your worldview. What did you go into it looking for?
Yeah.
You know, rather, it's that old thing of rather than letting the facts shape your worldview, you're letting your worldview shape the facts.
Yeah. Well, you know, people who are involved, say, in police investigations will always say that. They'll say, if you question five witnesses about a single incident that they all saw, you're going to get five differing accounts of it. And the trick for the detective is to figure out, you know, who's actually closest to the truth, or how do you get the truth. Because, I mean, they're probably all really reporting what they saw, or what they thought they saw, or how they perceived it. You know, but I mean, if you get somebody who says, well, the person had, you know, light brown hair. Well, if you get somebody who's from a family where they all have black hair, they might say the guy had very light hair. And if you get someone who's from a family of Scandinavians, they might say, yeah, his hair was kind of dark.
Yeah, I found out I've been misusing the word brunette all my life. I thought brunette meant jet black.
Oh, I thought
brunette
so, too.
Was jet black. No, it could be almost any shade of brown, I found out. Not the lightest one.
Yeah. I had no idea.
Yeah, so not only your worldview, but your very vocabulary and what you think people mean. That's something I run into covering the religious aspects of this, is that you have to be very careful. You know, when you're presenting a biblical point of view, you wouldn't believe if I say Jesus. You know, half the people are going to be talking about the Jesus I'm talking about, but there's five other New Age views or cosmology views and stuff like that, that people are just going to, according to their own worldview, interpret as Christ consciousness, or, you know, Because and if they're not, they'll walk away thinking you said something you didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the reason we end up with things like jargon, you know, which I find really annoying, but it's necessary because if people are working together in a particular field of study, you need to agree on the vocabulary.
Yeah.
The words don't necessarily have the same meaning that they do to the general public. And that's a reason why it's so important for anyone who's getting into the field of ufology, anyone who's new to it, to read the books, you know, read the literature. You don't have to agree with everything you read, but at least it helps you to understand the history and the terminology. And then you don't go around saying stupid things like there's no physical evidence.
Right.
They get everyone in the room to roll their eyes and say, please don't tell me that. You know, or I would get people that I used to work with who didn't know about UFOs, didn't care about UFOs, fair enough. And because of this, they didn't know anything about it, that's fine. But then they'd come up to me and say, well, you know, everybody knows that's not true because, you know, they're always just seen by one guy who's been out in the woods in West Virginia and he's been hunting and drinking all night.
Oh, yeah.
Like, okay. And they would come up to me and say, well, how come people don't see them over big cities? And they'd say, well, how big does the city have to be? Is Mexico City big enough? Is Los Angeles big enough?
Chicago?
Manhattan? Phoenix? Chicago? Exactly. I said, how many, you know, and are hundreds of witnesses at one time? Is that enough? And physical evidence? Yeah, you want physical evidence? Talk to Ted Phillips. He spent 30 years collecting physical evidence from various cases. Don't tell me there's no evidence. Or that, what's her name from, I'm getting all head up. Now I can't remember.
Uh-huh.
After Stan Romanek was on ABC last fall, there were a series of articles and interviews about him, and somebody, that Juju Chang, who introduced Stan on TV, also interviewed a scientist, and I cannot remember the woman's name because I probably blocked it out. She made me so mad. And this woman, who I want to say was from Harvard, but I'm not positive that's correct, said, well, that's, you know, no doctors or scientists believe in UFOs. And I was like, what do you mean no doctors or scientists believe in UFOs? You mean like Lynn Kitai, who's a doctor, or Dr. John Mack, or Stan Friedman, who's a nuclear physicist, which last I knew was a scientist?
Something written by Stan that was correcting that. He was on some documentary, his view was being presented, and he's like, the actual credential they gave him, Stanton Friedman, fringe researcher. And he writes, excuse me, is nuclear physicist not a good enough credential for you to include on air? You know, that's a very slanted documentary right there.
Yeah.
But.
Oh, my God.
That's what Steve Bassett calls the ghetto. We're in the ghetto, Karen.
Exactly. I know, when people make these stretches, and you know what kills me is then the people who don't know anything about the field, who are just reading the news or just watching a special on TV, they hear this and they believe it. You know, they'll hear a statement like that, like, no doctors or scientists really believe in this. And they're like, okay, well, then I don't have to. And I don't need to look into it. And the truth is, yeah, there really is something to look into. There is something really important to look into.
And then it's going to come down to, okay, you and I, we agree there's evidence. Then we got to start asking, what is this evidence of?
Yeah,
and that's where
and
within the field it begins to get hairy.
Yeah, well, which pieces of evidence are real? And, yeah, what are they evidence of? And if we look at two pieces of evidence, are they referring to the same thing? We don't even know that. And are they real or are they disinformation that was planted there by somebody?
Yeah, good point. And by the way, which pieces of evidence are you ignoring?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And, yes, there's a lot of stuff that can be ruled out as inaccurate or misidentified natural phenomena, fine, or they were, you know, false things that were planted. But you can't really clear them out of the way because it's almost like you have to go, you can't trust anybody. You have to go back and prove this stuff for yourself all the time. Because as soon as you start taking anyone's word for it, then you get one person like this woman who was interviewed about Stan Romanek who said, oh, no doctors believe in that. Well, you can't just take a statement like that. You've got to check it because it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And well, what that does is keeps anyone from making any progress because we're constantly retracing the same work that someone else has already done.
That's pretty intentional.
Well, that's just it, you know, and then we all come off looking really paranoid and like we're seeing conspiracies everywhere. Well, you know what? Sometimes it's because they're there.
Yeah, definitely. Jim Mars, you know, conspiracy theory. No, it's conspiracy fact.
Yeah, I love that.
There.
Yeah, well, like people talk about 9/11. Whatever you may believe about what happened on 9/11, I've had people say, oh, that conspiracy theory about 9/11 and roll their eyes. No, the official story was that more than one person was involved. We have evidence. Okay, there was more than one plane. Therefore, there was more than one person. That means it was a conspiracy.
Yeah, by definition, collusion.
Okay. Exactly. If there's more than one person doing it, it's
covert
a conspiracy.
Covert collusion.
Yeah. And whatever, even if the official story were true, if any of the other alternative theories were true, it doesn't matter. The point is, I am sick of people rolling their eyes at me when I talk about the 9/11 conspiracy. Because, you know, if they want to tell me that the Taliban was doing it, then fine, they were in on the conspiracy. Okay? But people just, it's like you were saying, people are not careful about the words they use. They're not thinking about the meanings of the words. And that's slowing things down as well.
Yeah. Before, did we do a break at the top of the hour? Like,
we have to go to break. It is 8:59, and we go to break at 9 o'clock. So I was just about to say, yeah, we need to wind this down for now.
Before we get off the topic, I just want to remember to invite you and other. I know you'll be here this summer, but, you know, something we can probably pick up on later is, you know, all these wonderful points of views and all these wonderful activities that we talk about are going on in Roswell for the last several years. The internal politics of the situation is this might be, or probably will be, the last year that the city of Roswell is involved doing UFO festival activities and symposium. All that's about to change, so I just kind of wanted to, hey, folks, come to Roswell. This might be the last big, great one, or it might
not be. Absolutely. Yeah, we don't know what's going to happen next year, but, you know, that's enough reason. Just the fact that Roswell is such a wonderful place, I just can't get over it. I mean, after the first time I was there, I just kept saying, oh, my God, I want to come back. It's a nice place to visit. Everybody's so nice. Well, yeah, I don't know if I'd want to live there because I don't handle the heat that well. But I'm not used to the dry air anyway. I'm in the Lake District up here. But
June, July, August, we're 100 degrees, but it's still livable because there's not any humidity, hardly any.
Yeah. You know, people say, well, it's a dry heat, but you know what? Inside my oven is dry heat, too. And I have to give Rich credit for that one. He came up with that, but it's absolutely true. It's still really, really hot. But the UFO Festival is amazing, and, you know, the people down there are just absolutely wonderful. And every time I go down, I'm like, oh, I got to do this again. I got to come back again. And I'm always crossing my fingers hoping I get invited back again, because otherwise, you know, I just have to find some way to get down there because I really, really want to go. And we're bringing the kids this summer, too.
So yeah, you told me that on email. I look forward to hanging with them or at least meeting them for the first
time. Yeah, I'm so excited that they're going to get to see it. So that's going to be really great. And on that note, we do need to cut to a break.
Okay.
I want to thank everybody who's joined us for the first hour of Through the Keyhole. Don't go too far away because we will be coming back in about 10 minutes or so. You have been listening to Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.5 FM in New Orleans. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and when I return, I'll be talking some more with Guy Malone of Roswell, New Mexico, and we'll be talking more about the upcoming events this summer in Roswell. Don't go too far.
We really do like a 10-minute break.
Yeah, about that. And I don't think we're off the air.
Hi, folks. Call in. Ask your questions.
Hey, everybody. Hey, Joe. We're going to break, right? Maybe we should just keep talking.
Yeah, as long as you know we're on the air, that's fine.
Hey.
You're the interviewer. What's the next question, Karen?
Well, hey, I'm sitting here getting messages from my producer that we need to go to break. And,
okay.
But now I'm not getting them.
Well, look through the Pal Talk, see if anybody's throwing out any questions.
Oh, you know what? A couple questions did come up on the chat room, and I can ask about this because it's about the Roswell event. Someone wanted to know who is running the UFO Museum, and I'm thinking that's still Julie Schuster, right?
Yeah, she is still the director. She has a board. So, yes, that is the correct answer to that question.
Okay. And then there was another question about Dennis Balthaser and what his role is there. Now, I know you mentioned he'll be speaking, I think, at the museum?
Not at the UFO Museum.
Okay.
He's like myself, you might say, but and Don Burleson are kind of estranged from the UFO Museum over the last several years. The city of Roswell, especially because they're locals, I think, and myself, you know, they have an investment in promoting local talent, and both of them have amazing credentials. But Dennis will be on the city's event. The two websites, other than Roswell UFO Museum, .org or .com, I'm sorry, that's the UFO Museum. But then there's also UFO Festival Roswell. That's the city's official website. And
okay.
Click on presenters, and you'll see Dennis is there. He is on Friday, right after myself. So that's going to be fun. I'm going to get up there and tell people it was man-made, and then I'm going to get followed and hopefully not too harshly rebutted by Dennis. Believe me, I'm doing my best to act humble and say, this is just a theory. You know, I'm just presenting it for you to think about, you know, because I know, like, you, Rich, Don, Dennis, and everybody else that's going to follow me and have a chance to, yeah, guys talk was good, but here's the details he's leaving out or something like that. I'm hoping it's not too brutal.
Yeah.
I won't be around for most of it anyway, but,
yeah.
I'm interested in your talk, how the Roswell incident changed ufology, and on Alejandro's talk on how it changed the worldview, you know, just the effects of Roswell in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm definitely going to promote people to attend both those talks, but I also want to say, but here's a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever Karen and Alejandro bring, and I recommend you go, if what I'm saying is even close to correct, what if everything they're telling you is based on a lie or a wrong belief at minimum?
Well, you know, that is something that in the field we have to expect that. We have to accept that possibility always, that, you know, what I'm saying is going to be based on the facts that I have, which may or may not be correct. They may or may not be deliberate lies or misinformation. They might be what we think is true. You know, everyone does their best. And, hey, if I go up and say something, if I work up a whole 90-minute presentation and then somebody can come up to me later and poke holes in it, great. I want to know.
Yeah, you're of the attitude that they're doing you a favor.
Absolutely, because I don't want to be an idiot standing up there saying the same thing at the next conference if it's all wrong. I mean, if somebody knows this stuff is wrong, then tell me. Yeah, because that's still advancing knowledge, and that's getting us a little closer to the truth. If somebody can prove to me that something I said is inaccurate, then great. Then I can prove to myself that I shouldn't be saying that anymore.
I think part of the problem comes when somebody has been, you know, you're talking about a 90-minute lecture, you know, come up and poke holes in it, but when somebody has published a book that's been out for 10 or 20 years that they've been standing by, that they're, you know, at least part of their income depends upon, that's when I think it gets really harder for someone to change their point of view, and not really based on greed itself, but, you know, stature, reputation, et cetera, to where you have to be extremely convincing to change someone in that position,
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the interesting thing about that is that if you have a book out and it's been out for 20 years, if I had written a book and it stood there as that was considered an authority for 20 years, I would be very surprised if after that length of time nobody came up with information that contradicted anything that was in it. And I'd be very, very sad because that would be an indication that the whole field is going nowhere.
I kind of agree in that I have said, you show me someone who's, because I agree with you, I mean, all of us are only learning to one extent, and there's often, I won't say always, but there's often new information that all of a sudden does come out of nowhere that you either have to incorporate in your worldview or just completely reject it and ignore, or in your view about even what we're talking about. But I've used the phrase a long time ago. Maybe I should make sure I slip it in publicly, or maybe I shouldn't, during the conference series this year, is, you know, you show me someone who's still saying the same thing they were 10 years ago, I'll show you a CIA plant.
It makes you wonder, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, seriously, we should all be changing our minds about some things. We should be making some sort of progress. And I can't believe that any of us is that good that we're able to come up with enough information to write a book and publish this book and never, ever, ever find anything that contradicts any of that.
Yeah, it has to be revised over time, I think.
And I would think it has to be, absolutely. And that's another thing that irritates me about people who will look at an old book and point their fingers at the author and say, well, clearly this guy was putting out disinformation, or he was deceived about this, or whatever. Hey, maybe the information that contradicted that piece of what he put in his book wasn't available yet. You know, stuff comes out. Things change. Documents come to light. Witnesses
yeah.
suddenly come forward. New information comes out, people. And if the author or the researcher is any good, what they do is they write a new one. Oh, sure, now we're getting a nudge, Joe. Okay, now I'm getting a nudge from the producer. We're going to try going to break again. We tried going to break, and we were still on the air talking, so okay. Let's try this one more time, Guy. When we get back from a break, we will pick up where we left off, talking about research into UFOs and the Roswell UFO Festival coming up. And once again, you're all listening to Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.5 FM in New Orleans. Don't go too far. We'll be right back. Hi, everyone. We're back, and you're listening to Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and also on UPRN 105.5 FM in New Orleans. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and my guest this evening is Guy Malone, resident of Roswell, New Mexico, former host of Live from Roswell Radio Show. And Guy is now heavily involved in the upcoming UFO festival, festivities, I should say, in Roswell. They're going to be over the 4th of July weekend. If you haven't made your plans yet to go to Roswell this summer, definitely do it now. I think now is probably the best time to get a flight, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And check out a couple of websites. Guy's website is www.alienstranger.com. There's also a site for the City of Roswell's UFO Festival, and that's www.ufofestivalroswell.com. And that's all one word. Excuse me.
And as our city's marketing director, Renee, says, not to be confused with our partner site, Guy's website, RoswellUFOFestival.com, which has been around a lot longer. I'm just good at grabbing URLs. I can't believe nobody ever thought of that one before
well,
I got here.
I was just going to say, you were really good at getting in there and snagging all the really obvious ones.
RoswellUFOCrash.com.
Yeah. There's a question on the website, or on the chat room here, before we get started. Somebody says, I wonder if there are any new alien UFO restaurants, cafes there now. I remember, I mean, there was the cover-up
I'm sorry
cafe.
To say no. Cover-up cafe closed.
I was
no
so
themed
sorry
restaurant.
Last summer when that was not open anymore. That was the greatest place. I really loved it.
I have to admit, I only went there when I had someone from out of town. Even as a local, you know, we didn't go there that often. We didn't support it, you know. I'm sorry, guys. But when someone from out of town was here, we did take them there and ate and spent money.
It was fantastic. I wish somebody would even just open it for the festival, you know, if they only did it during that time. I don't know if anybody could. I know nothing about the restaurant business, so I don't know how feasible that would be. But that was really cool. I remember walking in, and it just looked like you were in some kind of military facility, and there was a shelf with a couple of helmets up on it, and it looked for all the world like a couple of military guys had come in and tossed their helmets up there and sat down to eat. And
yeah,
you know, everything
and
was really nicely done.
Painted drab green. And
yeah.
I love those signs they had out there. Remember, call us to report your weather balloon.
Yes.
Only you can prevent mass hysteria.
Yeah, it was terrific.
Yeah, that was it was very expensive. That was a lot of land, if I'm not mistaken. Might actually rent for $5,000 a month.
Oh, my God.
And they just weren't doing enough business.
Yeah.
You know, and unfortunately, I mean, we get year-round tourism here, no doubt. But to support something alien-themed is, you know, the festival, you know, is it. It's obligatory. You're going to be packed in. Any business downtown is
yeah.
going to have huge business for a week. But even I found this out with my shop downtown, look at right across from the UFO Museum. Another reason they hate me. But
oh, we'll get
you visited,
into that in a minute.
You visited that.
Yeah.
You were there. And, you know, they, with that big No Alien logo we had from V2
yeah.
staring them down for 3 years. So I'm sure they were happy to see me close. But year-round, it's hard to keep something financed here. It just is. You know, I even lived in the store at the time. All my money was going to pay its rent.
Yeah, I remember going to that store. That was, I mean, the first time I was ever in Roswell. That was the first place we went.
Yeah, I remember Rich asking. It was the funniest thing because I'd sent so many long explanatory emails, and I remember Rich asking me, "Oh, just to clarify, am I getting paid for this?" No big deal, one way or the other, but just asking.
Well, we figured we were going to sell some books down there, and you know,
add Roswell
okay.
to your resume.
We're here, you know. Yeah,
that's always been my big hook, actually. I'll share a secret that I told on the 2007 festival committee that when I was new and the city had just invited me in, they really didn't know me from Adam, and of course they were highly suspect that I was some UFO cultist, of course,
mm-hmm.
because there are those in town that like to paint me that way.
Speaking of paint, yeah, well, not to mention that you like to paint yourself silver.
Yes, that happens.
I have to say that whenever I mention your name, my daughter says, "Is that the guy who paints himself silver?" Like, yeah, that's him. So she's
looking forward to
meeting you.
Oh, great.
Very cool.
Cool. Yeah, I used to use the phrase then, I put the shameless in self-promotion, and I put the fool in Fool for Christ. Yeah, I'd stand down there on that corner and hand out tracts and, you know, or schedules of events, whatever was going on, just to get some media and excuse to hand out a business card. And then people would go to my site, and they would get my view that they weren't getting anywhere else in town. That was good times. Haven't done that in a while. But the little secret I was going to share. I actually told the people that work for the city, and they're city employees for the most part. They're not UFO experts, or especially they weren't then. By now, 4 years later, a couple of them are, no doubt. Renee tops the list. But I said, well, look, here's who I've invited for the conference, but we have this whole big conference room with more and more people. And I actually told them, we don't have to invite anyone else and we don't have to pay any expenses. What you're going to find out is you're going to get email and phone call after email and phone call of people who want to speak at the festival. And they will be willing to pay their own expenses. All we have to do is say, our budget is already spent on travel and who we can host, but we do have a conference room that we'll give you for free to speak at if you can get here under your own power. And they told me, no way that will work. No way people are going to come at their own expense. And I told them, this is Roswell, the 60th anniversary. People don't care if they speak in a men's room. They just want to put on their resume they spoke in Roswell. And it happened. A lot of people came at their own expense. And it wasn't a tactic. We really did not have any more money to spend on inviting guests. But you guys were included, so.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking back, hey, wait a minute, I was there that year. Oh, no, you paid for us, so that was...
Yes. My apologies to everyone else.
You didn't speak in a men's room either, so.
No, not at all. But after having conferences for a few years, I just saw that dynamic happen, and I don't say that to offend anybody, but that is the dynamic. That's how important Roswell is, both in this field and globally.
Well, absolutely. You know, I mean, there have been events all over the country, all over the world. There have been sightings, there have been crashes of something. You know, there haven't been movies made about other cities. You know, the movie was Roswell.
Right.
The TV show was Roswell. Okay? That's the one everybody knows, and that's the big thing. I can walk into our post office here when I'm shipping out copies of Rich's book and Richard Souter's books, and I'm chatting with the women who work at the post office while they're putting the postage on all these things, and I'm like, hey, we're going to Roswell, and they know what I'm talking about. Like, really?
Yeah.
That's so cool.
You don't have to specify,
hey,
Roswell.
And they'd be like, yeah.
You don't have to specify Roswell, New Mexico.
Exactly. A lot of people don't even realize it's in New Mexico. They just know it's Roswell and it's cool.
Yeah, they think it's in Area 51, 800 miles from here. Thanks, Independence Day, for that.
Yeah.
For getting that wrong.
Yeah. No, it was a cover, right?
No, you're right.
It's just a little disinformation to help hide it.
Yeah. So. Probably knew that when they made the movie.
I'm sure. I'm sure somebody did. You know, every time I watch anything on TV or movies now that has to do with UFOs, I catch myself, I'm in this very paranoid, conspiracy-minded frame of mind. You know, whenever I see anything that's not strictly accurate, I'm thinking, okay, did they not know that, or are they just telling us that?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Ugh, I hate being like, I can't just sit back and watch a movie now.
Yeah. Yeah. Before anybody gets there, anyway, RoswellUFOFestival.com, that's my site. It's got the whole comprehensive schedule, what the UFO Museum's doing, what we're doing, what the city of Roswell is doing. I do my best to get it all on one printable page schedule and include everybody, regardless of the sponsors or, you know, who's doing it. And I'm kind of looking at it. I realized about a month ago putting it up there that, Karen, whenever you and Rich speak in Roswell, we're speaking at the library, so I was kind of thinking, it's kind of funny, you can, let's see, who starts? Karen Dolan at 1:45. Okay, if you come to the free lecture by Karen Dolan, How the Roswell Incident Took Ufology to a New Level, if you get tired with that, in about a half an hour, you can come over to my free lecture, Evidences for the Demonic Hypothesis. Yeah, Evidence, it's just a couple blocks away. I'll be doing Evidences for the Demonic Hypothesis of Alien Contacts. And if you get real bored with that, 20 minutes later, you can just leave and go see free lecture by Richard Dolan, Roswell in Fact and History. I had my schedule printed before the city. I wouldn't have purposely done that to us. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, I'm bummed that I'm going to miss your lecture now. I'm going to have to get the DVD when it's done.
Oh, you're on the free list. I'll send you. I'd already planned on sending them off to you guys.
Well, thanks. You know what? I keep finding that when we go to conferences, and the same thing happened at the X conference a few weeks ago. You know, I didn't get to see any of the presentations.
I think I saw half
of one. I saw Rich's.
Of course.
That was it. I mean, that was absolutely, and that was like I was in there hovering, and as soon as he started to sound like he was winding down, I headed out to the book table.
Yeah.
And I was at the book table the whole time. I never get to actually hear talks anymore.
Well, that's kind of what I asked you when I interviewed you all those long years ago now is, you know, that side of the story that I thought was fascinating human interest. But not only are we recording ours for DVD, and I'll plug it again, theinvisiblebattle.com, link from all the sites anyway. I'm going to do, using Vimeo, Vimeo is awesome, much better than YouTube, I think, because they're not 10-minute clips, and they allow for high-def stuff. In time, after we do the post-editing, and my free account on Vimeo only lets me upload one a week, every lecture that I do, the Roswell one, or the Man-Made View of Roswell, and the Evidences for Demonic Hypothesis of Alien Contact, Joe Jordan's talk, Josh Jowes, who's coming up from Florida also, UFOs and the New World Order.
Ooh.
All of these are going to be online for free viewing eventually.
Cool.
So even if you can't come, even if you don't have the money to buy the DVDs, just send me an email, get on a list, or watch the sites. Eventually they will all be online for free viewing.
Very cool. Well, yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting the DVD. I'm sorry that I won't be able to hear it live, though, to be there and, you know, harass you with questions. Actually, I probably could come and harass you with questions at the end.
Yeah, whether you saw the lecture or not. You're going to come in with questions really without having seen the lecture.
Absolutely. See, I'll ask really stupid heckling questions because I didn't know. Like, well, I'm in the middle, but what about...
That's kind of what you were saying people do. They don't even read the resources. They don't know the evidence, and then they make these odd statements.
Yeah, we get a lot of that.
Actually, since I'm presenting for the city, you will be available. I'm there at 8:15. If you're up, awake and coffeeed up, the man-made Roswell one, I will be doing when you're around anyway. walk knowing, like I said, gosh, I've got Richard Dolan and Karen and Alejandro and Dennis,
you know,
and Don following me.
I'm just thanking God that Rich is going after me and not me trying to follow him.
Exactly.
Because he's such a fantastic center. I'm like, please, 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 I don't care when I go, just please don't make it right after Rich.
Yeah.
So they put Rich right after me.
I've discovered that with Joe Jordan. I've done a couple conferences where I spoke after Joe Jordan and liked his material on stopping abductions in Jesus' name. However people feel about that, it's a powerful presentation, and it's a tough act to follow.
Yeah.
So that's part of our 1-2 punch is I go first now. I open. Okay.
Yeah.
What else are we talking
about,
Rod?
I missed your other talk, though, because actually, see, the one on the man-made aspect of the Roswell incident is really more up Rich's alley with the actual nuts and bolts, factual things. And I'm very much interested in the concept of the demonic aspect of this. I'm really, really interested in that.
Yes, I know you've been more open-minded than a lot of those in the field to saying. I had, when we were setting up a reservation here to do the lectures, someone actually said to us at the library, oh, so you guys are presenting the other side, right?
Ooh.
And we were kind of, well, yeah, whatever you want to call it. But I walked away from that. You know how you always think of the right thing to say 2 minutes
yeah.
later? Yeah, I'm like, what I want to revise, the next time I get asked that question, is no, well, you can say that, but actually what I think we're presenting is the most comprehensive side,
mm-hmm.
because there's a lot of stuff in the normal secular field of UFO research that we affirm. We affirm that there's physical evidence.
Mm-hmm.
We affirm that people are being harassed or taken or whatever against their will. We quote Jacques Vallée and John Mack and Bud Hopkins, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Where we differ is the worldview we have allows for all of this stuff without defining it necessarily as extraterrestrial. We're still asking, what's the proof that this is honest extraterrestrials? The box is a little bigger than you think, and when you look at the history of fairies, elves, djinns, genies, I know you're well-versed in all that.
I've always found it really fascinating, and as you mentioned, Jacques Vallée wrote in Passport to Magonia many, many years ago that, you know, maybe our long tradition of beings like elves and fairies and whatever, maybe they're the same things that nowadays we call aliens. And
yeah,
that is true. I don't know.
Yeah, even in what I call my freshman effort book, Come Sail Away from 97, you know, I read in Whitley Strieber, he raised that point as well. But I'm like, you know, 500 years ago, little beings with big black eyes, dispirited, unsuspecting loners away to caves, poked them with magic wands, had lewd sex out in the woods. Well, those were elves and fairies.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm suggesting, you know, this one crowd is going to ask, well, wait a minute. Is all the elves and fairies, and is all the mermaids, is all the angels and demons? Oh, well, look, well, that's proof of extraterrestrial visitation. I'm like, that's a pretty slanted view.
Yeah.
Is it possible that what you're calling extraterrestrial visitation is actually a spiritual entity simply pretending to be whatever you'll believe it'll be, depending on the period of time, era, and belief system you're accustomed to?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, people ask me all the time, like, I should know this stuff now because I've been in the field as long as I have, which is like a couple of years, and I don't know anything. I'm not a researcher. You know, I'm a talk show host. That's it. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I ask. You learn a lot doing this. I remember hearing one thing out of Buck Hopkins' mouth at the Las Vegas, the first crash retrieval conference.
Uh-huh.
And I think I said in the Ancient of Days opening remarks that you and Rich came to in 2004. I did say it. I saw it on video not too long ago. Is that, you know, we invited people here. You know, my view on organizing this conference is, every view is welcome here as long as it's based on your research and not your dogma. You've got to get up here and explain to people why you believe what you believe. As long as you can do that, you're fine. But then I went, for example, here's why I did not invite Bud Hopkins, even though he's a major researcher. I'm standing 10 feet away from him at this Las Vegas retrieval conference. Nobody really knows who I am back then, 2002 or 3. Somebody walked up to him and asked him, well, what do you think about all this abduction stuff? First thing out of his mouth was, well, one thing I know for sure is that it's not demonic. And the person asked him, why not? because demons don't exist. And I'm like, that is as open-minded as me getting up and saying, well, this stuff can't be aliens, you know, because aliens don't exist.
Oh, God, I cannot believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we're up against. You know, this is just so, it's so frustrating. You know, people will not look at what facts we have because they just have it in their heads that certain things aren't possible, that doesn't exist. Well, how do we know? You know, and that's what I was saying. People ask me these things all the time, like, I'm supposed to know. Well, who are they? What are they here for? I'm like, I don't know. The only thing I know for sure is that we don't have enough information, and I don't believe anybody who says they do know who they are and what they're here for. I believe, personally, that there's more than one group, and they may not all be the same thing, and they may not all be here for the same thing, and that's not really an answer, I know, but that's as far as I can get. You know, I think this whole field is way bigger than we think it is. You can't just say, who are they and why are they here? It's how many of them are there.
Yeah. And I kind of really like, I kind of, even though you know my view and Joe Jordan, I like, I'll say I respect the way I heard Rich, your husband, frame Joe's work. I think it was on the interview you did with Rich and Peter post-2008 conference, or it might have been when you had Joe on yourself, and I was listening to that one. It's archive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at least we've gotten to the point now of presenting to the mainstream, you might call it secular UFO research field, sufficient evidence that some of this is demonic. But I like the way Rich framed it, is that doesn't prove that it all is.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the burden of proof is still there, one way or the other.
Yeah.
But,
and you know, somebody came up to me at a conference once, and I'm so sorry, I don't recall the name of the gentleman who said this to me, but it was brilliant. Because we were talking about evidence and evaluating evidence and what you can learn from it. And he said, you know what, even if you look at one case and you prove that this one object that somebody saw was faked, it doesn't mean that there's no real thing that could be copied. He said, just because we know how to make wigs doesn't mean nobody has real hair.
I'll admit, on that logic alone, just because there are demons pretending to be aliens doesn't mean there's not really aliens. That's a whole other ball of wax.
Yeah.
Well, if I can plug one thing, though, and again, people can get this for free online eventually if they don't want to buy the DVDs. The newest thing in my, I guess, arsenal, you might say, is I've finally come up with what nobody else dares to touch, is I devote like a good 10 minutes or more of the lecture I do, the second one, asking and answering the question, what does the Bible say about life on other planets?
Mm.
And it's a tough thing. I can't really even encapsulate it here for you, or I would. But I did it in Nashville, and it, admittedly, it was a Christian conference, so you have to presume a Christian worldview going into this. But it was a two-day conference, 5 speakers on Friday, 3 ahead of me on Saturday. And when I finished that lecture, I got my left foot off the stage, and I had a woman come running right up to me and saying, that was the most important thing I've heard this entire weekend.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I take 2 more steps, and a lady's coming to me, can I please have your notes from this? Because I've been asked that question, I've never known how to answer it, you did it perfectly, I can't believe it. I had another speaker there ask me if he could trade lectures with me. He's literally asking, I need a new lecture. Can I have yours, and I'll give you credit.
Wow. Holy cow, that's fantastic.
Yeah, and oddly enough, the personal aspect was my father and my younger brother, who hates religion, politics, and all things that smell like it. They both were there in attendance just because I was in Nashville for the first time in several years.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not, you wouldn't call them, you know, highly Christian or religious or anything. They both loved it.
Oh, good. Okay,
so
where can we see this? Where can we get the DVD? Is it online?
You can't yet. He is actually doing a film. It's lastdays.net with a hyphen in it, last-days.net. And it was kind of a Christian end-of-the-age kind of conference thing. And we were just tickled pink that Joe and I got to speak at it, because most Christians that do this, that do all this end-time prophecy stuff as a industry, they next to never even mention anything having to do with aliens. And from what we were told, Joe and I, to quote, hit a home run.
Oh, that sounds like it. That's great.
Yeah, and I think it's going to, and we're repeating those lectures in Roswell. So what he's doing with that series, he's not selling like 10 talking head DVDs, as he said. He's trying to boil it all down to a 2.5-hour documentary.
Oh, okay. Well,
and he does have a trailer up for it right now. And it'll be out pretty quickly. He is a filmmaker, and he's quick about it.
Okay, so...
But the real lectures, theinvisiblebattle.com, you can pre-order DVDs, or you can just hang around for a while until we get them all posted online afterwards.
Okay, so that's going to be your presentation on the demonic aspect.
Yes. The talk description actually ends. Malone ends with, what does the Bible say about life on other planets? And I will tell, since, you know, I know the... how varied the audience on Paranormal Radio Network is, to swallow it, so to speak, it presupposes a Christian worldview, that you actually are going to believe what the Bible says, and that if you're asked on the street by another person, whether they're Christian or not, what does the Bible say about the other planets, the most important thing I sell on this is, forget what your imagination and your reason tell you are possible. God's not obliged to do something just because you and I can imagine it. Here's what the Bible says about imagination. Here's what the Bible says about your and my understanding. I'm asking you to walk out of here and only say what the Bible says. And that, honestly, is a better selling point, or a better hook, so to speak, than even the answer that I give to what the Bible says about life on other planets. Hmm. Is that I'm telling people, if you're going to get asked as a Christian... Kind of the context I use this in is, you're familiar with Barry Downing's work on UFOs in the Bible?
Yeah, I interviewed Barry on the show once.
Yeah, I know he's a Christian. He's very sincere Christian, believes in the divinity of Christ, the resurrection of Christ from the dead. But I disagree, you know, you might know, obviously, with his view that everything you see in the Bible is really a UFO. Well, part of the lecture, I quoted the video from History Channel of him. The Christian audience was shocked at the stuff that came out of his mouth. And I left him by saying, you know, he's just as entitled to his opinion about UFOs being in the Bible. If he's not going to quote the Bible directly, but he's just going to give his opinion, he's just as entitled to that opinion as you are about what you currently believe about life on other planets. And I know a lot of you found that offensive. Well, what you're saying might be offensive, too. I'm asking you, I'm charging you, walk out of here and only speak what the Bible says, and nothing more, nothing less. Don't add to it. Don't let your reason or imagination come into it. And it was a pretty good selling point.
Yeah, people really respond to that, you know, when you don't try to draw a lot of conclusions, jump to conclusions, and, you know, say, well, you know, you're here, and I'm telling you the way things are, and don't ask me for evidence, just here it is. And
yeah.
You know, you never do that. You draw...
Yeah, I'm usually trying to take the approach, don't believe me, but believe what, even if I'm quoting John Mack or something like that. And I'm doing the same approach with the Roswell talk, is that I know I'm only introducing this view. Here's the quotes, and here's how to Google it and find out for yourself, and posting all the links that I followed, and you can make up your own mind. But here's the information. Here's the direction you need to start on to arrive at a similar conclusion if you do the research yourself.
Yeah, I did that last year when I did the workshops in Roswell, which I'm going to be doing again this summer, too.
I saw that. You said
yeah.
that. I think it's on your... What are you doing?
I'm so excited.
I don't have that on my schedule. What and where are the workshops you're doing?
I don't recall. They were talking about moving them around, so I'm not positive how that's going to end up. Last year I did a couple of half-hour workshops, and there were like four of us who each did a couple of workshops here and there. And it was
UFO
a great idea.
Right?
I thought, yeah, it, you know, people keep saying, describing it as UFOs for kids and for families and all that because I did that Teletubby thing. But it's like, ugh, it doesn't have to be for kids. I looked at it as, here are all these tourists who come to Roswell, and maybe they're people who don't really know anything about UFOs. They just come
that is
the
most
tourist
problem,
aspect
yes.
of Roswell. And so I'd sit people down and say, okay, you know, what are we all here for? Why Roswell? What is it about this place? And why are so many, you know, seemingly sane people devoting so much time to studying UFOs, which is a pretty crazy topic? And I would just show them pictures. And, you know, when I put this together, Rich looked at it, and he said, don't you want more modern pictures? And I said, no, I don't want anything that could have been photoshopped.
Yes, yes, I love that.
Everything I use is from film. It's like up to the 70s, maybe. Those are the most recent things. And one of them is actually from 1876. It's, you know, this anomalous object on top of a mountain, and that's the only thing that was going on then were those airship sightings.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I like to show people these pictures, and I say, okay, these are actual photos. The negatives have been checked out. They've been analyzed. There's an actual object there. We just don't know what it is. And when we ask people who are supposed to be authorities, they tell us it's things like swamp gas or the planet Venus, which is clearly not even plausible. So that's why we're all here looking into this. And every time, I must have done three workshops last year, and every time there would be one person, it's a different guy each time, but there'd always be one really big guy sitting in the front row with his arms crossed across his chest, just looking at me like, yeah, right. He didn't even want to be there. And it would freak me out. You know, I couldn't catch his eye because it would be like,
yeah, it would unnerve you.
I know. And so I'd do my little half-hour shtick, and every single time I did it, that person would be the first one to come up and shake my hand and say, thank you so much for showing me this. You know, now I get it.
Oh, wow.
So that was really cool. And I love doing it. I'm so glad I got a chance to do the workshops again this year. And now they want me to do an hour long instead of a half hour. So that's going to
be
really
well,
fun.
Okay, well, tell me when and where so I can put it on the schedule.
As I find out, I will let you know.
Mm-hmm. Is Robert doing that with you? Is he kind of telling you, or is it some other group or organization?
Is Robert. Peter Robbins.
Oh, Peter, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, Robert LeVer.
Oh, LeVer.
Actually finding and. All right.
Yeah.
Well, folks, this could be the last big, bad Roswell UFO Festival.
We have about 5 minutes left. Do we have time to get into the whole.
Well, yeah, just the simple facts of the matter are that it was Mayor LeGrone, when he was elected in 2006, he realized, and I don't mean to trash talk, but locals Dennis Balthaser and Don Burleson can back me up on this. You would walk downtown during the 2006 festival, and you couldn't see 20 people in all directions standing at that main intersection downtown, and the word of mouth, people were writing letters to the Chamber of Commerce, to the city. They didn't know who to write letters to the editor on, you know, I came all this way and that's all there is. And knowing it was a 60th anniversary, the new mayor realized that the word of mouth was bad. It was bad for repeat business and tourism, so the city put a ton of money, or not a ton, I think started with $50,000, but the lodger's tax, you know, the money, the tax that comes from hotel rooms being filled, put up the money, and the city got involved, and they made all kinds of more and more presentations. You know, people left saying, there's so much to do, I couldn't do it all, I have to come back next year. That was our plan. But 4 years have gone by, the numbers of the festival have really been high. They've exceeded the state average for hotels and, you know, tourism. Everything else is down 17%, we're up 20%, you know, kind of thing. But 4 years later, there's a new mayor, and he does not either endorse, or he doesn't want the city to put its employees and resources into doing it, is sort of the word that's going around. The Roswell Daily Record did an article, or an editorial. It begins with, we've heard a lot of strange ideas relating to the to the incident of 1947, but we've also heard grumblings that the city is not going to be involved this year, and of all the strange ideas we've heard, that's the strangest one of all.
That the city won't be involved this year?
No, after this year.
Next year, after this year, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I don't understand that. To me, I mean, I know that this whole UFO-related tourism has got to be huge for the economy of Roswell.
And you're right.
It doesn't seem to sound like, you know, Roswell's nothing without the UFO thing. It's not that at all, but truly, that has to be a very significant part of the economy there. And I don't understand why someone who's in the position of mayor of this town that relies so heavily on it would just say, no, we're not doing that anymore.
Don't know his reasons. Haven't talked to him personally. Met him, but it was before he ran for mayor. I don't know if he'd remember me or I'd even remember him if I hadn't seen his photo when he was running for mayor. But I don't know. I can't speak to those reasons.
Yeah.
I did ask him on an online chat forum when he was running, and he was answering people's questions on his candidacy, what's your position on the UFO festival, and that one went unanswered. But, you know, I'm not going to say it's going to fizzle, because no matter what happens, we've got a good reputation from the last couple of years, and if nothing else, the bar has been incredibly raised. So, depending on, there may be a private organization that'll start up its own thing eventually, and it may or may not only be what the UFO Museum puts out. But the UFO Museum has been having so much more to do themselves in the last few years. You know, just it's economics 101. Nothing's better for the consumer than competition. You know?
Yeah. I've never understood why there has to be competition. I don't see why, even if you have two or three or whatever number of events going on in the same town over the same weekend for the same reason, what's wrong with, you know, for example, during my talks, during my workshops, I would say to people, if you want to learn more, you know, right outside there's a whole vendor area full of researchers who are out here ready to talk to you, and go down the street to the UFO Museum, and there's another whole building full of really intelligent people who have this information.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always treated it like different aspects of the same event, and I don't see why it shouldn't be like that, but it seems that there are people involved in this, and I'm not going to name names because I don't actually know who they all are, but it does seem like some people really are jealous of the opposing, what they see as opposing events.
And that's
I don't see
wrong.
It as opposing. I see it as
very complimentary.
One big thing.
And especially if you're doing the same talk or the same speakers that you had last year or the year before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, Karen, I've seen your talk. I like it, but, you know, I got two other choices now.
Yeah,
so I'm
going to
go this direction this year.
Exactly.
This year I've got you on DVD. I know what you have to say.
Right.
But so it's very complimentary, I think, to give people more.
Yeah, and I would say, absolutely, if you saw my talk last year, go down to the museum and see what they've got going on this time.
Exactly.
Yeah, you need to see all of it. And then, you know, come back the following year and check out Guy Malone's conference, because he's got a whole other slew of things and interesting speakers to hear. And, right, you can't do it all one time.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we're going to do something next year or not, honestly.
Yeah.
We're out of time. I can't go in and tell you why.
Well, you know, I'll have to get you a night off from work again sometime so you can come back on the show.
Yeah, afterwards. A couple months afterwards, we'll probably have some new good stuff to report for you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's got to be
God
a huge amount of work and a huge financial commitment. And, you know, there are times when I think it would be fun to put on a conference, and then I come to my senses and think, absolutely not.
Yeah, talk to Victoria Jack.
Oh.
Talk to Ryan Wood.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, I guess you might say I'm not a woman, so I might not be allowed to say this, but in a lot of ways, I've heard it's like having a baby. It consumes you for 9 months, like most conferences do.
I can imagine.
Afterwards, it's worth it. But you swear to yourself, never again.
And then the next year,
you're
doing it again.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like it's just like that.
Well,
okay.
I don't know if we got a lot of viewers or listener questions and stuff, but I'm guymalone@gmail.com. See if anyone wants to follow up and ask me stuff.
Cool. We did get several questions, some that I brought up and some we just answered in the course of our conversation, so I didn't bother to mention them. But I do want to thank everyone who joined us this evening, and thank you especially, Guy. It was a real pleasure having you on the show, finally. I know we've been
watching. Oh, yeah. It's always good to talk
time.
To you. You're great.
Thanks. Well, we do have to do this again. Whenever your schedule allows, give me a call. Get you on here.
Okay, like maybe September, October. I think I can actually swing it.
Cool.
I can't tell you why now, but
okay. Well,
a little teaser there.
We'll set it up then. Okay, thanks everybody. You've all been listening to Through the Keyhole live on the Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.5 FM in New Orleans. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and stay tuned now for the Joyner Report coming up next with Angela Joyner. Thanks for listening, everyone. See you next week.